Welcome to the AT&T teleconference replay system. At any time during the conference, the following functions may be performed. Press 7 to rewind 30 seconds. Press 8 to pause. Press 9 to fast forward 30 seconds. For volume control, press 0 followed by 4 to decrease the volume, or 0 followed by 6 to increase the volume.
Hancock Bank provides this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions during the call, please email them to David Lundgren. His email address is David, D-A-V-I-D, underscore Lundgren, L-U-N-D-G-R-E-N, at hancockbank.com. Okay, let me go ahead and introduce our speakers. First of all, we have John Portwood, Chief Investment Officer, David Lundgren, Director of Equities and Research, and Jeffrey Tangus, Director of Fixed Income. Dave, go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Ashley. John, we'll go ahead and start off with the economy as we always do. And when we met last, we talked about the economy had turned the corner, and I don't think we're ready to back off from those comments yet, but January truly was a bit more mixed in terms of economic news. Just to go over some of the numbers, from a bad news perspective, fourth quarter nominal GDP was reported at just 3.4%. That was almost a full 2% below expectations. The good news is that real GDP has now exceeded its 2007 peak, so we're officially in expansion phase. On the employment front, U.S. initial unemployment claims, the four-week average crept up to 429,000 after getting very close to the psychological 400,000 number that many economists were hoping that we would pass. Seems like we've backed up a bit there. In terms of home prices, prices continue to struggle. So that's the bad news. I guess on a positive side, we have seen a bit of an uptick in existing home sales. And finally, I will end with some good news. Consumer confidence surged to 60.6 in the month of January. We have a more confident, more financially stable consumer. And that reading was the second highest we've had since the summer of 2008. So, you know, given all of those numbers, John, statistics, where do we really stand in your opinion, and what's your outlook?
The fourth quarter did turn out to be more mixed than some people had anticipated. As the quarter progressed and we began to see evidence that retail sales had increased considerably more than anyone had originally anticipated, there were whisper numbers floating about a 4% GDP quarter. That seemed to be a little bit high given trends that had existed prior to the end of the year. And as it turned out, the number, as Dave said, was 3.4%. Even that was a little bit odd given the underlying data. And this is kind of like inside baseball when you examine the GDP numbers to see what really is happening beneath the surface. But it appears, given initial estimates I've seen from economists, that the 19% roughly increase in imported oil prices at the end of the year created a mathematical anomaly, and I won't say any more than that, but it would take 15 minutes to explain it, a mathematical anomaly in the GDP numbers to make GDP appear to be about anywhere from half of 1% to 1% lower than it should have been, I said that wrong. It should have been higher than that. No, wait.
You said it right.
Did I say it right to begin with? Anyway, so there were a lot of cross currents there that that seemed to make the numbers a little bit strange. The savings rate came down a lot too, and given that employment cost indexes, which give you some idea of what's happening to wages and incomes in the economy, are not doing very well, nobody really expects the rate of spending that existed in the fourth quarter with sort of a holiday flip to it, I suppose, to continue into this year. But in any case, the leading economic indicators still look okay. It's reasonable to anticipate that we'll have something approaching a 3% GDP growth rate, I guess, for at least the next 6 months and maybe throughout the year. So the situation looks reasonably decent. It just doesn't look like we have achieved what a lot of people like to talk about is liftoff, where you have really a tremendously strong economic growth rate that resembles what we had 3 or 4 years ago. So that's probably not likely to occur. One thing that appears to be cropping up, too, currently is that while the leading economic indicators are still very positive, the Economic Cycle Research Institute is noticing some slowdown in what they call their long leading global index, and that's a measurement that does not include stock prices. And in the past, it has been reasonably accurate in judging whether or not you have, let's say, passed the peak in economic momentum. And they are sort of suggesting at this point that we may have passed the peak growth rate in the economy coming out of the recession, and that from this point forward, things are going to be, you know, somewhat more moderate. So again, it all falls into place, I guess, from what Rogoff and Reinhardt are suggesting happens after a credit bust. You have a recovery, but it takes a number of years to really work through all of the excesses until you get back to something more normal, and in the process, your economic growth rate is somewhat moderate. So not bad. I mean, you know, it's not terribly exciting. It's just okay.
We're moving along. All right, good. Commodity prices, again, we talked about this last month, fourth quarter, you saw a tremendous rise in commodity prices. And, you know, what's kind of interesting is if you look at headlines from around the world, it seems that inflation is popping up across many, not only emerging markets, which you would kind of expect with a rise in commodity prices, but a lot of developed countries across the globe are beginning to see a general rise in inflation. Yet here in the U.S., if you look at the core CPI number, which I guess is the most common number that economists and strategists look at to measure inflation, if you look at the core CPI in the U.S. on a year-over-year basis, that number is 0.8%. I'm very confused, John. What's the disconnect? How can we have inflation everywhere, but yet here, you know, hardly any?
There's always been a controversy about how to measure inflation, and some of the confusion comes in when you try to measure cost of living, and we all have different costs of living depending on what we spend our money on, and a rise in the general price level. And the economists always look for measurements that give some idea of what is really happening to inflation across the entire spectrum of goods and services, whereas a cost of living index will not necessarily measure that. And if you look at the core number, which excludes things like energy and agricultural commodities, it has a much better correlation between what the actual inflation rate is in a broad sense, and also it appears to have much more of an accurate correlation with inflation going forward than what you might get by just taking a general survey of investor explanations. But commodities and energy prices are excluded from the core because they tend to be very, very volatile. They go up and down quite a bit over complete cycles. And sometimes the energy cycle will tend to last more than a few years, at least it has in the past. But I think just looking at oil for the last few years, you recognize it's been pretty volatile without just going into what's happening to the prices there. But on the agricultural commodity side, of course, there have been a lot of weather-related agricultural supply disasters that have created the high prices recently. And if you look back over the last 20 years and look at the Dow Jones UBS Commodity Index, which one of our research sources conveniently gave us a picture of yesterday, you see these tremendous rallies and declines in agricultural prices over the last 20 years that show absolutely no trend at all, but certainly you have a lot of volatility. For example, You go back to 1990, this particular agricultural commodity index was at 100. 2 years later, it was 200. 2 years later, it was back at 100. 2 years later, it's back at 200, and so on. There have been three or four rallies and declines like that in agricultural commodities, and the last two have been fairly close together. There was a peak in 08. The agricultural commodity complex collapsed, and now it has risen again back to peaks that we have seen off and on over the last 10 years. And, of course, that's creating a lot of problem in a lot of other countries around the world. But the underlying inflation rate is closer to what the core rate suggests. Now, for inflation to continue to accelerate from here, you're going to have to see it in wage gains, and the borrowing, lending, and spending cycle that we've talked about so often would have to really kick in and get started in a very big way. And so far, you know, we don't see that sort of thing happening. Also, you know, while the rise in commodity prices is going to certainly add something to headline CPI going forward, unless the rise in commodity prices continues, even that's going to come to an end. So, you know, commodity prices could plateau and stay where they are, and the inflation rate's not going to change any because it's no longer rising. You know, unless, of course, you know, something happens to some other indicators. But
other types of spending.
Yeah, unless other types of spending really kick in. But right now, unless you see this borrowing, lending, and spending cycle really kick in a big way, then it's probably unlikely that we'll see any high inflation anytime soon in a general way. The other problem is there's excess capacity everywhere. Even the Chinese have excess capacity. So, you know, we're not talking about capacity constraints or supply constraints only in the sense that, you know, there might be some hoarding going on in the commodity complex here and there. So,
so likely this is a the commodity price is a short-term blip and just normal volatility and should subside somewhat.
Right. I mean, it'd be highly unlikely for this to continue uninterrupted for very much longer.
Okay. Stocks have seen a similar rise in prices as did the commodities. And, you know, we had a really strong end to 2010, and 2011 got off to a great start. The S&P 500 finished January up almost 2.5%. Very nice month. Some interesting stats that may have aided the rally. The Dow flirted with 12,000 for the first time since June of 2008. Revenue growth has been very strong, 7.8% top-line growth for S&P 500 companies. If you exclude utilities and financials, that number grows to over 11%. Fourth quarter earnings so far for S&P 500 companies through Friday, 42% of them have reported, 71% have beat, while 17% have missed. And that, you know, generally you have more companies than beat because they play games with expectations. But even given that 71% number is a bit on the strong side. What's your outlook? Is you know, are we in a continued positive trend for stocks?
It looks like the trend is positive. We can argue about the degree, I guess, at this point. But as Dave said, earnings prospects are positive. We may have passed the peak growth rate in earnings, but, I mean, that's pretty normal when you get into a cyclical recovery. But, you know, there's no indication that earnings are about to roll over and die at this point. You know, again, the leading economic indicators are pretty good. We don't see anything from an earnings standpoint to give us a lot of concern. Also, on the positive side, if you want to look at cycles, and, you know, we look at cycles. We don't, you know, place a lot of big bets on them, but certainly it's worth taking a look at. If you consider how strong the market was in the fourth quarter of this year, which is relatively rare, I mean the fourth quarter of 2010, which is relatively rare, and you look at the performance that has occurred thus far in 2011 for what's happened in January. Looking back historically, the odds are very, very high, almost 100% that you'll have a positive return this year. Now, you know, don't go out and, you know, roll the dice and bet a whole bunch of money on that. But in any case, the historic cycles would suggest that this should be at least a positive year. Now, that doesn't mean it may not be volatile along the way, but certainly the cycles are lining up for it. And it's also the third year of a presidential, you know, election cycle, so that tends to be positive. To kind of temper our enthusiasm, though, we have to mention that from a valuation standpoint, the rise in stock prices from the low back in late 2008, early 2009 has eliminated quite a bit of the longer-term expected return you would expect from common stock. So if you look at stocks now, given the valuation work that we have, you'd have to say stocks were somewhat expensive, and that just looking at the major market indices, you know, like the S&P 500, for example, the cap-weighted index, you know, returns going forward probably over the next 3 to 5 years are going to be somewhere in the low single digits, you know, given history. Again, we always like to mention that, you know, each sector and each specialty index and, you know, individual stocks do not always march in line with the index. So, you know, there'll be opportunities to do better than the index over time. But certainly from, you know, an index standpoint, it looks like, you know, a good bit of the return to date already reflects the good economic news that and good earnings news that is likely to come, but at least we don't expect a disaster around the corner. And from a long-term investor standpoint, you know, the thing you want to be most concerned about, of course, you know, is the economy growing to a degree at all, and are earnings making some progress? And as long as that is occurring, then, you know, the risk of, say, a severe setback is probably less. But you may or may not have read the highlights that just came out yesterday, but I included a chart for the last long consolidation period between 1966 and 1982, just to give people an idea of how volatile these periods can be. And certainly everybody knows we've been through a volatile period for the last 10 years, and it could be that over the next 3 to 5 years, if it takes that long for us to work out of some of the excesses created by the bubble and we get back to more normal markets, we could have a good bit of volatility along the way. And you know, we're not really concerned when we see 15% and 20% rallies and declines in the market. We've seen too many of them over time to get overly disturbed about a lot of these, particularly if, you know, we're not looking at a you know, really horrible economic situation. But it could happen over the next 3 or 4 years. We could have several advances and declines of 15%, 20% each, and it really wouldn't necessarily change the economic picture in any way. Just a warning to be prepared for something like that if it happens to occur.
I would say 5% to 10%. Not totally disturbing. I'm not sure about 15% to 20%, but
I don't know. I've seen too many of these in my life, I guess, to get overly concerned. But obviously, you know, we're up 90% from the low in 08. And giving back, say, 20% off the top to where you're only up 70%, sure, that could happen. You know, it could happen Monday if something happened in Egypt. But
well, I know one thing that really could shake up the market is, you know, and it has historically, is any type of political instability or unrest. And I was kind of surprised yesterday that we had a decent day given the news out of Egypt. And what's going on over there, that I guess that's the latest hot spot for political unrest, and maybe that was the big sell-off that we had Friday was a result of that. But the market, you know, seemed to shrug off the news coming out of Egypt. If you could, walk us through a couple of scenarios on how this may end, and what is the effect on the U.S. specifically, and then economies across the globe?
Okay, as many of you probably know, the Middle East has been a problem area for a long, long time, and Mubarak's problem and also the problem in Tunisia where, you know, the last president was run out of town recently by unrest. You know, that situation existed for a long time. Everybody has known for quite some time that there's a powder keg over there in a lot of these countries where dictators are firmly entrenched, and they have good bit of control over the economy, and the economies are relatively poor, and of course that creates a lot of issues by itself. But in any case, in Egypt's case, the general feeling now is that if the army can maintain control and if they can arrange some sort of smooth transition from Mubarak to someone else, given that the next election cycle is scheduled for sometime in September of this year, then things might work out fairly well. The concern, of course, is that the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been active in Egypt and I guess think was founded there back in the 1920s, that could come to the fore, seize power in some way, and create another Iran, so to speak, in the Middle East. And that, of course, is the big fear. Current thinking is that the Muslim Brotherhood probably does not have as much control as they might have had 30 or 40 years ago because Mubarak has been stepping on them pretty good. But certainly that is a concern. Given everything I heard last night and what I read this morning, I'm beginning to think that the process will be drawn out over a long period of time with really no resolution in terms of what the final government is going to look like. It may take a few years for this thing to work out. If we can get past the next week or so, I guess we'll be in pretty good shape. I did get something last night from a different source suggesting that Mubarak would be gone by this weekend and that they would have...
I saw that as well.
And they would have, you know, some other kind of transition process in mind. But Egypt gets about $80 billion a year from the Suez Canal, and so they're not about to shut that off from the standpoint of oil. And they need tourist dollars quite a bit. That brings in a few billion a year. So, and obviously tourism is out the window in Egypt now for a while, and that's probably going to hurt considerably. But at this point, it's still kind of fluid. Everybody is hoping for the best, but I don't think anybody really knows exactly down the road exactly how this thing will work out.
Jeff Tang, is you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Jeff.
Good morning.
Good morning. I guess the last few times we've met, we've talked about a general increase in bond yields, and I guess January we saw very little movement. I was looking at it yesterday, and the 2, the 5, and the 10-year Treasury are all within 10 basis points from where they were at year-end. Are we range-bound now?
Well, that's a good question. For the most part, yes. I mean, we had a reset at the latter part of last year as some stronger economic news came in. We saw some good employment data come across, and so there was and of course the stock market showed some real good returns. So we saw some, I guess, really some disintermediation out of treasuries in the latter part of last year, and then that pretty much stabilized beginning this year. We had some softer employment numbers that came in, and everybody was getting adjusted to the new world order. It became apparent that the Federal Reserve was going to continue their quantitative easing program. They weren't going to cut it short. That was a concern. So essentially everyone has sort of taken a step back in the fixed income markets to reassess the economy and inflation and try to figure out if some of the signs that we're seeing of economic life and possible inflation somewhere out on the horizon are near-term concerns or just something to keep an eye on out there. And Dave, you and John touched on that already. The end result was people are really getting comfortable with we're in a scenario of slow growth, not explosive growth, and that in general, that's good for bond investing. The one place that there is an exception there, which is out on the very long end, and on the very long end, there just aren't many buyers because of the great uncertainty that does still exist out there. So while the point you made, 2, 5s, and 10s are generally speaking unchanged, the 30-year has reset. But for the most part, what has happened is that the 30-year has essentially made the move that that most people anticipated earlier. I think the 30-year right now is about 4.65. Most people seem to think at the end of the year it ends the year at 480 and ends 2012 at 5. So essentially nobody is anticipating dramatically higher yields on the very long end at this point. And of course the Fed still is controlling the short and intermediate term with the quantitative easing program. So if the economy does continue to improve, we might see some gradual drifting higher of short to intermediate term rates, but for the most part people are comfortable with the kind of the equilibrium spot that we found right in here. Of course, if the stock market were to sell off, chances are we'd see a dip in rates. Political unrest around the world were to grow, we'd probably see a dip in rates. So there's a lot of caveats that go along with that. But essentially, the overall theme is that we're seeing a modestly improving economy. And with that, there's probably going to be some pressure for rates to drift higher, especially after we get past the middle of the year when the Fed's quantitative easing program comes to an end. But certainly nothing dramatic, at least on the horizon at this point.
Okay. We want to stick within our time frame, Jeff. I want to ask you one other quick question, and then we have a couple of email questions in. So just real brief. The muni bond market continues to be in the headlines. Any update on that, and maybe just a quick bit of advice to clients that are thinking about fleeing the market because of all the headline news?
Yeah, well, that's a hot topic these days because in the latter part of last year, Meredith Whitney, a very high-profile analyst, made a very bold and call on the municipal market saying that there will be a number of very major defaults. Lots and lots of people have come out of the woodwork from the rating agencies to PIMCO. All the heavyweights have said, wait a second, you know, we just don't see that. But you had that at the latter part of last year in conjunction with a large supply, which is pretty traditional at year-end, coming to market. So you had a lot of supply with a lot of fear in the market, and that really was a perfect storm for dramatically higher interest rates in municipal bonds, really going into just after the first of this year. But what we've seen is the rise has, as people have come out and given the a more level-headed analysis of the municipal market, and that most of those situations seem to be localized in all the problem states that we know about with real estate problems. We've seen a lot of buyers come back into the municipal market. As a matter of fact, I think I lost count, but the last 8 or 9 trading days in a row, most of the bond funds have been up in NAV, a sign that people are buying back in. We're also seeing signs that people who don't normally buy municipal bonds, in other words, taxable bond buyers, are actually buying tax-exempt because the yields are higher and they recognize the extreme likelihood of some capital appreciation as the market comes back into equilibrium. So there's a lot of cross currents right now, and I would just encourage everybody to not take a broad brush approach to municipal investing, but look specifically at where those municipal investments might lie and see if those particular areas are stressed. Chances are, if you live in this part of the country, you don't have any issues at all to worry about. So if this works out to be nothing more than really a great buying opportunity.
Okay. Let's go ahead. If anybody has any questions, go ahead and email them in now, and I do have a couple already in the queue. John, apparently there was a report on the news last night, a prediction that terrorist attack is much more likely in the next couple of weeks. How do we reply to clients' questions or concerns about the negative impact this would have on security markets? Is there anything they can do? You can't prevent, but what type of action should clients take, or is that fear out there forever?
I think your last comment is probably more accurate. The fear is always out there, just like what happened recently in Tunisia and Egypt. People have been writing about that potential for decades. You just don't know when it's going to occur. Same thing about a terrorist incident. You can assume we're going to have one. You just don't know when it's going to happen or where it's going to come from. And the only example of that we have to go back to, of course, is what happened 9/11. which hopefully we have nothing like that again. But if you remember, the market was actually closed for a while. The market dropped significantly. Within about 6 months, the market was back to whatever level would have been dictated by normal economies and markets. So historically, that type of thing creates a temporary impact, but it doesn't last.
Okay. Well, one last question, and then we'll have to wrap it up. Big news yesterday from Pensacola, where a U.S. judge ruled the health care law is unconstitutional. It seems that this is definitely going to the Supreme Court, and will probably do so pretty soon. What is the impact to the markets now? Good news or bad news or yet to be determined?
If you believe, as I do, that too much government control is probably a negative for the economy, then this would be good news because it would imply if the Supreme Court does say that it is unconstitutional, that entire project has to be reworked and perhaps reworked in a more, let's say, market-friendly manner, or at least in a manner that also reduces the future spending levels implied by the way it is currently written. So there is that hope that, of course, if it does get rewritten in a better way, it will mean less government spending going forward and maybe less government control over the economy, which, you know, by itself is something of a negative. And certainly it would be good for a lot of the medical companies and prescription drug companies at this point, you know, to have that revised.
To be continued.
Okay, thank you everyone for listening in. We'll talk to you next month. Any further questions, please email us and we'll answer them best we can. Thanks and have a great day.